Thank you. Well, I want to thank the organizers, wherever they may be, for giving me the opportunity to come here. I guess I'll be on record as having said that now, thanks to the recording here. And also to the institute directors and so on for organizing this program. It's really, I got here yesterday and I'll be here for 3 more weeks. So if something about my talk strikes you as worthy of bugging me, you have 3 more weeks to do it in. So I'd like to share with you some results that we've been finding about the role that the first stars could play for the reionization and metal enrichment of the high redshift intergalactic medium. This is mostly work I've been doing while I've been a postdoc at the University of Colorado in Boulder. I want to acknowledge my collaborator straight away, Jason Tumlinson, who's now the Hubble scientist at the University of Chicago, but he just graduated, defended his thesis at the University of Colorado. So some of this is his thesis work that I collaborated with him on. Mike Schell, also at Boulder, and Jim Churin at the University of Chicago. The work on the reionization from metal-free stars is now out on AstroPH. It's been accepted by APJ. It should appear next February. I realize I don't need to state these numbers in this crowd, but I just wanted to throw up again just how little baryons make up of the mass energy content of our universe. But despite the fact that the first stars are a small fraction of the baryons that we have to work with in the universe, they still have a very noticeable effect on the early universe, both from the aspect of ionizing photons and altering the chemistry of the high redshift universe. So we're talking at most a few percent of that 4%, yet they've made a noticeable difference. I just want to review why we think the first stars are significant at high redshifts. In the currently favored CDM paradigm, we think that the first stars form at redshifts of about 10 to 30. And where exactly they form is not well understood yet, because we haven't quantitatively resolved the nature of the radiative feedback in high redshift halos. What I mean by that is we don't know whether once baryons fall into a halo, what process they use to further fragment into stars through collapsing and fragmentation. We know that there's no metals in high redshift, the first halo, so we think they have to use molecular hydrogen, but it's also clear that a trace level of ultraviolet radiation can destroy the molecular hydrogen in high redshift halos. So the issue that's unresolved is whether star formation can proceed through molecular hydrogen cooling, or whether it has to wait to use hydrogen line cooling, which needs relatively high temperatures, 10,000 Kelvin or higher, which means you have to wait for more massive halos to form. So that's the unresolved issue here. But there's at least two sets of observations from which we think the first stars are expected to be cosmologically significant. One is the hydrogen reionization of the intergalactic medium, and the second is the metal enrichment, which we see up to redshifts of about 3 or 4. You see a trace level of metal enrichment, and I'll go through these in detail, why we think, particularly for reionization, stars are important. So therefore, understanding the evolution of cosmic stellar activity is important for cosmology. And furthermore, we expect, in some basic sense, a correlation between the number of ionizing photons that stars make and the number of metals that they make, simply because the mass of stars are doing most of the work there. So the more you have them, the more you should have of each. But I do want to point out that this connection is actually fairly tricky to make in a way that's independent of the progenitor metallicity, and I'll talk about that in the second half of my talk, because the properties of these stellar properties change strongly with the progenitor metallicity of the star. So there's that factor, and what that really means for cosmology is that the way you relate these things are redshift dependent, because the metallicity of star forming regions is changing with redshift. Okay, just a quick background on reionization. until fairly recently, people had not detected the Gunn-Peterson, the absence of the Gunn-Peterson trough led us to believe that the IgM was highly ionized up to redshifts of about 6. And this problem was being bracketed from opposite ends. People were looking through spectroscopy and pushing up the redshift of reionization. And from the other end, the microwave background was steadily lowering what could be the possible redshift of reionization through increasingly high quality data on the temperature and isotropy. And now DAISY has detected polarization as well. The current limit from the microwave background, I think, barring something that MAP might be putting out imminently, is that the optical depth to reionization through electron scattering is less than about 0.3%, 30%, and this leads to a model-dependent constraint on the redshift of reionization being less than about 25. And we do expect far stronger limits from these satellite experiments because they will have the all-sky coverage to get to the reionization signature at low multiple moments. That's where the signature of reionization, at least the primary signature, appears in the polarization spectrum of the CMB. Yes. In fact, I've heard a rumor that MAP has found something. I don't actually know. Well, you know how rumors get. It's like within like 10 whispers, they're very dramatic. But what I heard is that MAP has detected an extended epoch of reionization. So it's not sort of localized. It's not an abrupt transition. It might be kind of long. And I don't know, I think there must be some truth to this rumor because there's been a number of papers on extended and double reionization sort of appearing on AstroPH. So I'm not sure, but well, there's I don't have a graph of that in this talk, but essentially to get at you'd need to detect CMB polarization at large angular scales, which is low multiple moment in the CMB, and reionization has a unique signature that produces a new bump at during the process of reionization that's not from recombination, but really from reionization. And you can relate.
New bump in the polarization.
Yes, that's right, at low L, yeah. Because the higher L polarization power spectrum gets damped by reionization, just like the temperature and isotropy. But essentially, the location and the width of the peak, you can tie that to the duration and epoch of reionization. And I'm suspecting, I haven't seen the data, and again, I haven't talked to anybody on that team, but I'm suspecting what they've seen is a higher optical depth of reionization than we would believe from the Gunn-Peterson studies, meaning we think reionization from these absorption line studies should be between Z of 6 and 8, which tells you, because we are now pinning down the cosmology, what the total tau should be. So if you get a higher tau than that, that means there's a tail of partial ionization that we're not, and so I'm suspecting that's where the rumor of long reionization is coming from, but I don't really know. But that's how you'd pick it up in the CMB. Prior to the polarization detection, all you could place was upper limits, because all you saw was the damping of the multiple moments. So you could place an upper limit on the optical depth to reionization, basically. So, okay. So there were a number of models out for what the reionizing sources could be, like stars, quasars, mini quasars. There were some papers out in cosmic rays and galactic winds as well. But the leading scenarios at present involve photoionization by stars or mini quasars. And I'll come back to why we think it's mini quasars and not what we actually see to exist in the high redshift universe, which are the massive quasars. So there's been a number of papers on this. And what the theoretical models tell us is that the redshift of reionization, if we put in our best guess for the astrophysics of reionization, and then what we believed to be the current cosmological parameter set, the universe should reionize hydrogen between 6 and 20. And like I said, the observational limits are 6 to 25. And the current data data from about a year and a bit ago imply that hydrogen reionization may occur not far beyond Z of 6 to 7, and that helium reionization does occur at redshifts of about 3. Oops. So let me just show you this evidence. Some of you may have seen this already, but for those of you who haven't, this is from the paper by Becker et al., which was doing Keck follow-up to some of the Sloan observations of high redshift quasars. This quasar is at Z of 5.8, this one 5.82, 5.99, 6.3. And all I want you to take away from this is that blueward of the quasar's Lyman alpha emission line, there's still a little transmitted flux for these quasars, but it's sort of dropping steadily. And here they make a case for it being absolutely black, meaning that the IGM is becoming opaque. So that is the basis on which they claim that reionization is occurring not far beyond this highest redshift quasar. But of course, the caveat is it is only one line of sight, it's one quasar, but it's really hard to find. Quasars are so rare that it's going to be hard to find many at this redshift, but the hope is that they will find more. I think the projection is they should find about 20 more between redshifts of 6 and 8 or something. So we'll see how that pans out. And another way of showing this again is just the optical depth, the transmission. This is the transmission, this is the optical depth. And again, the Gunn-Peterson optical depth is just sort of, they make a case for a noticeable rise beyond redshifts of 6. So the idea is possibly hydrogen reionization could be occurring. You could be kind of probing the tail end of reionization. Very similar graphs exist for helium at redshifts about 3. But the case for helium is actually quite strong now. There is an epoch of reionization occurring for helium at redshifts of about 3. And we think that's just from the rise in the massive quasar population, which peaks at redshifts of about 3. So they're causing helium reionization from their hard ionizing radiation. So why do we think stars are particularly important for reionization? Well, if you look at the space density of the large bright quasars in the universe, they peak at about redshift 3, and then they fall off up to the highest redshifts of observations. And I think there's a number of papers by Madow and other people showing that already at Z of 4 and 5, either the ultraviolet or X-ray photons from these quasars are insufficient to keep the universe reionized. So you need to have an alternate population. It could be stars, it could be mini quasars, but we think that it has to involve photoionization. And that argument for photoionization comes from the line widths of specific ionization states of metals in the intergalactic medium. The second line of argument is more direct. Stars are the only objects through which we believe we can create metals in the universe after the Big Bang nucleosynthesis period. And they could account for this persistent metallicity that we see in the Lyman alpha clouds up to redshifts of about 3 to 4. And one point I want to emphasize here is that this argument for the ubiquitous enrichment of the Lyman alpha forest really comes from detection of carbon 4, which they see, so carbon, they see down to the lowest density column systems at these redshifts 3 to 4. So the specific element they see is carbon, and we'll come back to this in the second half of my talk. So if you take just the metals that you see and you simply convert it to the associated ionizing radiation, so you're just taking what you see and you say, well, how many ionizing photons does that produce for a star making these metals? It's something like 10 ionizing photons per baryon. So clearly stars must have played some role, if not the dominant role, in reionization. And again, the line widths show that they're photoionized. And finally, there are some arguments from the spectra of high redshift quasars that there's a softening of the intergalactic ionizing background beyond redshifts of 3. And this used to be called evidence for a stellar component at these high redshifts. This was based on the idea that, well, quasars have hard ionizing spectra, stars have softer ionizing spectra. But as I'm about to show you, that distinction breaks down for metal-free stellar populations. So In the past, the observational evidence for the fact that helium seems to reionize later than hydrogen, you know, in Z of 3 rather than Z of whatever it is, 6 to 7 or 8, was usually taken to be consistent with the fact that you need harder ionizing photons to ionize helium-2, 54.4 eV rather than 13.6, 4 Rydbergs rather than 1. And the fact that helium-2 recombines many times faster than hydrogen, so you just need it to turn on a harder source for longer to get helium-2 to reionize. So people thought, well, sources of helium-2 reionization are likely to be quasars, which have relatively hard ionizing spectra. And that was compared to stars of metallicity down to about 10 to the minus 5, where our sun is 0.02. But recent work on metal-free stars has shown that metal-free stars are fundamentally different from their lowest metallicity counterparts, and they indeed produce a large amount of helium ionizing photons during their main sequence phase. Just as a quick review, the lifetime of stars goes as the inverse cube of this. Sure.
Are there any other things that have ever been considered aside from collision and ionization?
Such as? People considered a number of things. Collisional ionization. So people looked at cosmic rays, people looked at supernovae, people looked at a whole bunch of different things. I think the thing is that when people began to look at redshift 3 and above, the IGM looked relatively, well, cold for collisional ionization to be relevant. It's at about 20,000 Kelvin, 30,000 Kelvin, and the line widths are not sufficiently excited. I mean, they're not broad enough to suggest collisional ionization. So people did look at
and all these other things like cosmic rays and they're just not intense enough to do it.
Yeah, and there's also a certain amount of heating that goes with that. So because cosmic rays, you need to have a certain amount of energy in them to reionize the IGM, there's a certain amount of heating that goes with that that we don't see in the intergalactic medium, for example, from supernova blast waves propagating into the IGM. So we think they cannot be the dominant mechanism for reionization. It has to be just photons, ultraviolet photons, doing the work, because if you have a very strong X-ray background too, there is an associative heating that we don't see. Does that answer your question? So the general trend as we go to lower metallicities is for the massive stars to get hotter and bluer, and by that I mean greater than 10 solar masses, and to have lower net metal yield as we go to lower metallicities. And the other trend is that certain elements, the alpha elements like oxygen, silicon, and sulfur, tend to come from these short-lived massive stars, whereas elements like carbon are created by longer-lived intermediate mass stars, 3 to 6 solar masses. So again, to reinforce a point that I mentioned earlier, these probes of stellar activity are themselves changing around with the progenitor metallicity, and hence with redshift, because the metallicity of star-forming regions is altering as we go back in time. So the first stars, we expect them to be metal-free, and I'll just call them population 3 or POP 3 here, just because we don't make any more significant quantities of metals in Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And therefore, they're expected to have fundamentally different evolutionary properties, and I'll show you why. However, the studies of such stars have remained largely theoretical up to now, because we have not seen these populations either in our own backyard in the galaxies. You see low metallicity stars or very low metallicity stars, but not zero metallicity. We have not seen them at high redshift yet, although we do have some papers out on what the signature of these zero metal stellar populations could be at high redshift. But anyway, for now, they have not been detected yet. But yet they must have existed at some point in the past. And the question is, of course, when and for how long such a phase of star formation lasted, and what observational consequences it could have. In a first paper, Jason Tumlinson and Mike Shull constructed evolving synthetic spectra for POP3 stellar populations. And They focused on stellar masses in the present-day disk IMF, so 1 to 100 solar masses. There have been some papers talking about the fact that the IMF could have been top-heavy in the past, and they have some theoretical arguments for that, but we did not focus on that. We focused on the present-day disk IMF, but I just want to point out that there are works out there which also look at stars more massive than this, and what they do is also produce helium-2 ionizing photons just at a boosted rate because they are so bright. So the main difference that comes for the structure of metal-free stars that will be important for cosmology or reionization is that because these stars have no metals, they're driven to use the PP chain rather than the CNO cycle, which is far more efficient. And therefore, what that means is that they need to contract to a far smaller size, which makes them hotter, and therefore they emit harder radiation. Yes?
So, observationally, what is the metallicity that you
can
PoP3
is zero metallicity.
Yes, but
Okay. I guess I would say more we don't know what PoP2, you know, the next generation's metallicity is, really. I mean, it could be 10 to the minus 4, it could be 10 to the minus 3, we don't know. But from a theoretical standpoint, population 3, I mean, it's just the idea is to focus on the zero metallicity star. So I don't understand the error bar. Observationally, okay. I think so. There is no PoP. I mean, I've not seen a data paper that claims to have detected a PoP3 star. Most people just say, well, we found a very low metallicity star, PoP2, in the halo component of our galaxy. And I think the lowest is something like 10 to the minus 3 or 3.5 solar. So that would put it at 10 to the minus 5. Total metallicity. I don't know the error bar on that, actually, but they have got some really good data now. I think the Beers group and the other groups do, but I don't know the error bar on that. But yeah, part of the theorist arsenal is zero metallicity plus or minus zero error bar. but yeah, data-wise, they haven't been seen yet. So.
But when is the metallicity when you use
So at what metallicity do we change? Yeah, I'll show a graph for that, which will be important to understand the properties of these stars. Okay, this is a graph of the energy generation rate per hydrogen atom versus temperature. And this is just a graph to show you what trace amounts of metallicity can do to drive stellar evolution. This is the PP chain, and you can see the energy generation rate is very flat. With a function of temperature. So the star needs to work a lot harder to get up to the required energy generation rate. I think this is for the interior of a 20 or 25 solar mass star. And this dashed line is what's required to hold itself up. And you see as soon as you introduce a trace amount of carbon in the core of the star, this is metallicity of 10 to the minus 11. So this is really very low. This is 10 to the minus 6. You can get to this point here. This particular star cannot really compete with the PP chain, but as soon as you get up to a 10 to the minus 6, you can get to the required energy generation rate at far lower temperature. And what that means is that puts us in the realm of the familiar stars where they have softer ionizing radiation. They don't need to contract to the point where they're so hot and they're producing hard ionizing radiation. So these are graphs. I don't know how I'll read out the numbers for you. This is the ionizing photon production rate. This Q naught is for the hydrogen ionizing photons, so all photons above 1 Rydberg in photons per second. This is Q2, all ionizing photons for helium-2, which is above 4 Rydbergs in photons per second. And these are stars that are at 100, 70, 50, 20, and so on down to 7. So you can see that the mass of stars are really doing most of the work. And if you then add these up, you can get to these graphs. So we consider two cases. One is an instantaneous burst where you put all the baryons into a burst at time equals zero. And then a continuous star formation rate, where you put the baryons in steadily at one solar mass per year. So this graph is a little busy, and I'll try and walk you through it. On the left are the two cases, instantaneous and continuous. And this is just looking at the evolving composite spectra for the entire stellar cluster. So we had a synthetic cluster of a million solar masses. And the red lines are for population 3, zero metallicity. The black lines are a fiducial or a test population 2 for comparison's sake, which we take from the starburst package from the Lederer group. And these stars have metallicity of 0.001. So I want to emphasize straight away that this is a 20th solar, so it is not that low. And the only reason that we're driven to this is because this is the only group that has calculated detailed evolving spectra as a function of metallicity, and this is the lowest metallicity that they have. We have tried to put in a few data points of our own for trace metallicity, which I'll come to in a minute, but I just want to emphasize that this choice of population 2 is one more of convenience rather than being exact, but it will give us a sense of how things change when you go to zero metallicity. So this is a time...
What are you using for distribution masses?
1 to 100 solar masses in a saltpeter MF.
How do you decide how to assign, like how many 1 versus how many 1?
Well, we use a saltpeter MF, yeah. Yeah, you could weight it some way. I mean, there's a lot of IMFs out there, but we wanted to try and understand if we just put a present-day disk IMF into a POP3, like a zero metal street star, what would happen. Yeah, so this is at 1 million years, and the curves evolve in the direction of the arrows, and you can see that the POP2 cluster fades very quickly, both for hydrogen ionization here at 912 angstroms, and also for helium-2 ionization, which the population 3 has a strong tail for the helium-2 ionization at 228 angstroms. It has a lot of photons blueward of that. This is for the continuous star formation rate. Again, a lot more helium-2 ionizing photons. And if you now take this and just transpose these, so now this is the ionizing photons, the Qs, Q0 and Q2, as a function of time for the instantaneous case and for the continuous case. Again, the red curves are POP3, the black curves are POP2, and what I want you to take away really is just that there's some gain in hydrogen ionization, but the gain is very dramatic for helium ionization, some 5 orders of magnitude. So the numbers are about 60% more hydrogen ionizing photons for POP3, but about 100,000 times more helium ionizing photons. These additional points are just to show you what would happen if we introduced a trace amount of carbon in the stellar core. Again, that means the star doesn't need to drive itself to such high temperatures, but it can, in fact, use the CNO cycle. And you see that for 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 6, the gain in helium-2 becomes, the helium-2 ionization drops very dramatically. So we think that this is a real difference, that when you go to whatever the metallicity of population 2 is, you can make a case for the fact that POP3 is significant for helium-2 ionization relative to POP2. And finally, these curves are showing you what happens when you include the Wolf-Rayet phase. So we did not include mass loss or nebular emission for the majority, for all of these curves, but the dotted lines show you what happens if you include the Wolf-Rayet phase, which is strong mass loss. Again, the Wolf-Rayet phase is thought to have a strong metallicity dependence. When you go to low metallicities, you simply don't have the opacity in the stellar atmosphere to drive strong mass loss, and we don't expect it to be relevant for metal-free stars, and we expect it to be marginally relevant, but it's just to, we put this in just to show what could happen. And you see that there's perhaps a little spike, and at late times it comes up. But again, there's a 2-order of magnitude jump. I'm sorry, maybe it's more like 1 order. Yeah, 1 order of magnitude jump. So we think this difference is real.
I wonder how much of that difference is because of your POP3 models, and how much of it is because of the inadequacy of the POP2 models. Because it's well known that all of the POP2 models, Lydra, mm-hmm. even some recent ones, mm-hmm. predict no doubly ionized helium
yes.
in low metal acidity systems.
Mm-hmm.
And roughly half the Isotop and Tuon sample H2 galaxies of low metal acidity have observable doubly ionized helium.
Mm-hmm.
So there seems to be a problem with the POP2 models, although there probably is the difference. POP2 and POP3, a large part of that may be because the POP2 models are inadequate.
Yes, I agree, and I think there's a lot of stellar evolution phases that one could add, like the Wolf-Rayet phase, and like you say, there's a lot of considerations which could, at some level, reduce this gain, and I completely agree, yes. And I think our hope here was to kind of bracket the range of consequences for reionization from these two populations, but I completely agree, yeah. So, yeah, definitely keep in mind that they could lie in between these. And again, we don't even know what that transition metallicity is, so the likelihood really is for the real universe that there was a family of curves that contributed to reionization here. So I'll just go through this quickly. The reionization model that we use to now input the spectra into is described in a recent paper of mine in the microwave background. It's basically a semi-analytic reionization model where we use the Prescher formalism to follow the evolution of structure. We use this the current favored cosmology parameter set. We normalize to sigma 8 of 0.9 at the present epoch. And we do include IgM clumping, but in a limited way, in the form of a spatially averaged clumping factor. Because it's a semi-analytic model, we can't follow the detailed spatial variation of the clumping factor. We set the fraction of baryons in each galaxy halo-forming stars to be 5%. And we set the escape fraction of ionizing photons from halos to the intergalactic medium to be 5% for hydrogen and a half of that for helium. So these values for the astrophysical parameters are a compromise between studies by numerical simulations and what we see from the data. This is a compromise between the lower limit of 1% from numerical simulations and the fact that this can't be much higher than 15%, because otherwise you would over-enrich the intergalactic medium and metal. It's more than we see it. The escape fraction is also a compromise between the range of data for the escape of H ionizing photons from local galaxies, which lies anywhere between 3 to 10 to 20%. So again, I want to emphasize these are important parameters which we don't have a handle on really, just a few data points and some studies. And we halved it for helium because, again, it's harder to ionize helium, and helium recombines faster. So even if you have a wave of ionizing photons, the helium-2 will recombine faster, and you need to keep a source on for longer. But again, this is kind of a first guess. We know that we believe it's unlikely to equal or exceed F escape for hydrogen, but I want to say straight away that we don't know what this number is. There are a sum total of 0 data points for this number. So, what I'm about to show you are the volume-weighted filling factors of H2 and helium-3, and if you believe most of the baryons are in the intergalactic medium at high redshifts, which is what simulations seem to indicate, then these can be interpreted equally well as the average ionization fraction in that species. Okay, so for this parameter set, here's the evolution of several quantities here. For this curve shows the evolution of baryons in collapsed halos. So if you weight this by F star 5%, you'll get the fraction of baryons forming stars at any redshift. This is for the continuous star formation model and the bursty star formation model. And this is for purely population 3. So all you're looking at here is population 3 spectra and what they do. So this is for helium and this is for hydrogen. And I'll give you the numbers for what the reionization redshift is for each of these cases. So you can see that the continuous star formation case reionizes the universe earlier relative to the bursty. And that just ties directly back to the fact that for the continuous case, you just have stars producing photons, and there's no fading of the stellar cluster, whereas this fading does occur in bursts, because you're putting all the stars in at time equals zero. Okay. We also considered a number of models where we had population 3 on for a certain time and then switched to population 2. And these, there's, I show two cases here. One is for the POP3 timescale being 10 to the 8 years, and the other is the POP3 timescale being a billion years. And again, this is something that we don't know how long they last, but this was just meant to bracket the effects for the intergalactic medium. And again, POP2 is what I showed you from the Lederer group. So you can see that it doesn't make much of a difference for hydrogen whether how long POP3 is on, because POP2 is not that different from POP3 for hydrogen. But for helium, there is a dramatic difference. This is for 10 to the 8 years. You see that it's at very low levels and has sort of come up to a trace level of ionization by redshift of zero. And for the billion-year timescale, you reach a maximum of about 60%. And then if you turn off the POP3, you're effectively taking away the helium to ionizing photons. It all recombines. And we have, I show two curves here. This is for a clumping factor of 30. You see it all recombines very fast and joins the POP2 curve here. And this is for a clumping factor of 1, which is basically a homogeneous IgM. And I just include that because there's going to be a large fraction of the IgM that are in void or underdense portions of the IgM. There's going to be a large component of the IgM by volume at late times that is basically underdense or in void. So they might not recombine as fast. So I included this curve to give you a sense of what the range in the helium to ionization fraction could be after POP3 stars turn off. I do want to point out there's something that is missing in these graphs, which is that we don't include massive bright quasars, which we know exist. They come up in space density from Z of 6, and they are peaking at Z of 3, and we don't include them here. So you should not believe these results below redshifts of about 4 or so, because we know that there's an extra source of helium-2 ionizing photons. But here what we wanted to show was that POP3 stars could provide a partial ionization or some seed ionization, and potentially they could reionize helium at high redshifts, which then recombines and gets ionized a second time. So the numbers here are for hydrogen, the range of redshifts for reionization was between 4.7 and 9 for the continuous and bursty modes of purely population 3. And for helium-2, it was between 0.7 and 5.1. And this is for pure POP3. And this range is consistent with the observational epochs for these quantities. When we consider POP3 switching to POP2, then we get that the redshift of hydrogen reionization is between Z of 8 and 9, depending on how long the POP3 phase lasts. Helium-2, as I showed you, does not reionize completely in any of the cases, but the most it gets along is for the case when POP3 star formation lasts about a billion years, when it reaches a maximum of 60% ionization at Z of 5.6. So this is some indication of what POP3 stars can do for the intergalactic medium as far as reionization with our best guess astrophysical parameter set and the current cosmological model. Okay, I guess I have about 20 minutes or maybe 10 minutes left. I want to spend a little time on the metal production aspect. I'm just going to focus on tying the ionizing activity of stars to the metal production of stars. And I'm not going to spend time specifically on metal transport and so on. There's been a number of papers by a lot of groups on the fact that trying to understand how supernovae and stars, star formation, can get metals out to the intergalactic medium. Here I really want to focus on whether the connection between ionization and metal production is made consistently. So some diagnostics that look at this connection are the number of ionizing photons per baryon in the universe, which comes from the conversion efficiency of energy in the between the amount of rest mass in metals produced to the number of hydrogen ionizing photons. And in this paper by Madow and Shull, they derived that this value is about 0.2%. So they claimed that this was independent of a number of input factors, and that you really could go from the number of metals produced by a star to the number of associated ionizing radiation. And so people were using this diagnostic to connect the metallicity seen in the IgM at high redshifts to the amount of radiation that could come from stars. And of course, there's a number of uncertainties which I've listed here.
MZ is the number of
metals.
Number of protons that could turn into metals,
basically. Yeah, I mean, Yeah, I mean, this is the mass of metals produced, but yeah, you do get at that from the 0.007 conversion factor for the, well, depending on whether you use the PP chain or whatever, but yeah, you do get at that from that. But this is the net amount of, you put a certain amount of mass into a stellar cluster, and you vary a number of parameters like the IMF and so on, and they were claiming that you can, despite the fact that we don't know a lot, like the IMF and the mass range of stars that form at high redshift, in the end, there was this sort of direct link between the integrated metal output and the integrated radiative output. So they ran this for a number of models. Oh, I'm sorry. This is what comes out, yeah. So the net metal yield, so not in the interior of the star, but what if they focused on the mass of stars in the IMF, so greater than 8 solar masses, and they looked at when these stars exploded as supernovae, what was the net metal output, and what was the net radiation output during their main sequence and post-main sequence lifetimes. Yeah.
If you counted the metals that's hidden in the stars, it'd be much more
smaller. Oh. Yes, but I think that's the idea of the net metal yield. I mean, you right. I mean, you kind of factor in, yeah. So, like I said, you can go through a rough calculation, and you can show that, yeah, if you want hydrogen reionization to occur before redshifts of 6, and you also want the same stars to do the enrichment in carbon that we see, this trace level of about 10^-2 or 2.5 solar in the intergalactic medium, you can do both with the same population of stars if you assume that F star, the fraction of baryons in each halo, is of the order of 1 to a few % for continuous star formation. And you can also derive then that the number of ionizing photons per baryon is about 10. And this is reasonable.
Excuse me, I'm a little confused. You made the point earlier on. It's things like oxygen produced in the massive stars and carbon in the lower mass stars.
Yeah.
So why compare it to carbon?
Exactly. I completely agree, actually. That's what I was going to talk about. A lot of people have kind of looked at the carbon enriched. They've looked at the number of metals seen in the carbon and then made a connection to the number of, because you can derive a metallicity associated with the carbon, and then they've gone from that metallicity to what they think is the background gas metallicity to the number.
The metals are in carbon.
Exactly. So that's what I'm about to show you. So I redid this eta calculation for POP3 yields and so on. So I want to state that there's a couple of potential problems, just like Gary was just saying, with trying to normalize consistently the reionizing stellar activity with the amount degree of carbon enrichment. The ionizing photons come dominantly from the massive stars in the IMF, so greater than 10 solar masses. And like I've already said, carbon is produced dominantly by intermediate mass stars. I want to emphasize that this holds true even for the very massive stars, the top-heavy IMF that people are now postulating higher redshifts. Those stars still produce low amounts of carbon. So this is not something that is different for the highest mass end, the 300 to 1,000 solar mass stars. So you're probing different regions of the IMF, and these might not be mutually constraining, for example, if the IMF was different in the past. I haven't assumed that, but I just want to point that out. Secondly, if you have burst-driven star formation, so not continuous star formation, there's also an issue of, well, if you put all the stars into this IMF in a burst, the carbon, most of it is produced in order of magnitude and time after all the supernovae go up. So how do you get it out to the IGM? So this is something that I think has not really been addressed consistently in the literature. And I think people have done some very good work, but this is an important point, because the whole argument for the ubiquitous metal enrichment comes from the carbon that you see. And just to convince you that this is true, this is the IMF weighted yield in ejected elements. And the red curve is the total yield in metals. The blue curve is for oxygen, and the green curve is for carbon. And this is weighted by the IMF, but this is just to show you that carbon is an intermediate mass star product, and that oxygen is being produced primarily by the massive stars. And this is for equals 0.001 metallicity. And this doesn't change much with metallicity, actually. The trends just get stronger. So let me now show you what I've done. This is work with Jim Turin that I've been looking at. So we want to calculate this eta parameter, so the number of hydrogen ionizing photons per metals produced for massive stars, as a function of metallicity, but also as a function of the element that you pick, because that's important for the high-redshift IGM. So you see that solar metallicity, if you focus just on the metals, it's pretty close to what Madow and Shull found, 0.2%. But as you go to low metallicity, you're producing more ionizing radiation and less integrated metal output, so you're increasing the numerator, decreasing the denominator, and as expected, when you do that, you're getting to relatively high eta's for metals. But notice how much stronger this trend is for carbon. This is for oxygen. I've just put this in there so you can look at it. But you see that already at solar metallicity, this is a lot higher than the number by Madow and Shull. And as you go to zero metallicity, you're getting to numbers of 0.45, so significantly larger than 0.002. So what does that mean?
So large numbers means inefficiency in producing metals.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Exactly. Or you're producing, if you want to achieve a certain metallicity, you're producing a tremendous amount of ionizing radiation. Exactly. So if you go through then what this means for the number of ionizing photons per baryon, where this is calculated using this eta parameter in this following way, which is the energy of the Lyman continuum photons per baryon divided by the average energy of the Lyman continuum photon in your stellar spectra. When you go through this calculation with eta of 0.002, you get a number of about 10, putting in the metallicity of the IGM here. So if you want to apply this to the IGM carbon abundance, so keeping everything the same, but just changing the eta for zero metallicity stars, and if you put in this number that I just showed you in the table, you get something like 700 ionizing photons per baryon, which is absolutely enormous. So the point I want to make here is that you have to have one of two things happening. Either population 3 stars reionized the universe but did not make the metals, well, the metals that you see in the IGM in the form of carbon, or that if they did do the enriching, they detected a tremendous amount of ionizing radiation, which you should see with NGST as very bright stellar clusters at high redshift, because that is a huge amount of ionizing radiation. So until this point gets resolved, this conversion factor should be treated with caution. All right, so I'll go ahead and summarize. We find that metal-free stars are significant sources of hard photons at high redshifts, and we know that these stars must have existed at some point in the past. We don't know for how long, but they must have existed at some point in the past. And there are about 60% more ionizing photons generated and about 100,000 times more helium-2 ionizing photons generated by population 3 relative to population 2. And like I've said already, this gain factor for helium could be smaller, but we think it's at least one order of magnitude. For the currently favored cosmology, population 3 stars can be cosmologically significant for reionization, given the right combination of astrophysical parameters and that they can last long enough, particularly for helium-2. So the point, what we found is that this could result in epochs of a partial ionization, or helium-2 might reionize more than once. And finally, the relation between the integrated ionizing radiation and metal output from population 3 becomes complicated because of the strong dependence on progenitor metallicity. So it's extrapolating these low redshift numbers back into the past where the star-forming regions are getting to lower metallicity and are likely to be changing a lot from galaxy to galaxy, it should be treated with caution. The one point I want to make, though, is that these population 3 stars are unlikely to be the source of the carbon detected in the IGM. But this rests very heavily, of course, on the reliability of stellar evolution models, right? I mean, all of this is assuming that that stellar evolution is an exact science. But I think there's been a number of groups which have been finding the same yields and so on. So I think we're on relatively firm footing here, although the exact numbers could change. And like I've said here, if the star formation occurred in bursts, it does get really problematic, not only to transport the carbon to the IGM, because you don't have supernovae anymore, and you don't really get more than like a little whimper out of planetary nebulae or something. So you don't quite get the bang of type 2 supernovae. But it also becomes hard to relate reionizing stars to the metal enriching stars for the IGM. This is just a preview of things to come. I'm working with Keiichi Wada from the National Observatory of Japan on numerical simulations of looking at how long metal-free star formation can last in the high redshift universe. This needs some kind of detailed spatial resolution of the interstellar medium in high redshift galaxies, because you need to understand on average how long it takes once you produce a wave of metals for them to get reincorporated into the next generation of stars. So this will give us a sense for cosmology how important population 3 stars are and how long their spectra are relevant for their IGM. Also looking at if you have an epoch of partial helium-2 ionization, if they recombine, they will produce, they will alter the thermal evolution and the chemistry of the intergalactic medium, which I'm hoping to look at with the Colorado group. A couple of points I want to make as far as the data goes. If it is true that hydrogen reionization is occurring at redshifts of 6 to 9, then Lyman Alpha will no longer be a great probe of the high redshift intergalactic medium, because we're going to stop seeing it at some point. But certain metal lines which are longward of Lyman Alpha are still potentially useful to at least look at the metal evolution of the intergalactic medium. The only trick will be getting from this ionization state to a metallicity of the IGM, because you still need to get a handle on the neutral hydrogen content. And that will be tricky, but it'll still be interesting to see. We don't have to rule out metal line studies completely, because these are a long word. But that's something to keep in mind, which is we've been lucky so far, but the universe may reionize relatively quickly beyond the current observational threshold, in which case we'll have to focus on other lines. And finally, the hope is that NGST will aid some of these observational searches for metal-free stellar populations by detecting recombination lines and emission from POP3 stars, either in a present-day IMF or if they were in a top-heavy IMF, they too have distinctive observational signatures. Thank you. Yeah.
A couple of questions. Mm-hmm. One is your first item up there. Did I understand what you intended by the project you said you were involved in? That the issue isn't the lifetime of the stars, but really the time scale for incorporating the metals into the next generation of stars?
Right. So as a follow-up to these reionization studies, what was interesting, what I thought was one of the questions that would be a dominant factor in seeing if POP3 stars were relevant at all. We completed the study, but we don't know how long metal-free star formation can occur in a halo, in any given halo at high redshift. So what we're doing here is trying to look at focusing on an individual protogalaxy and going down to a resolution of, I mean, less than a few parsecs, really, in the interstellar medium. So now we're not looking at the intergalactic medium at all. And what we do is we put in a burst of metal-free star formation in clouds around the galaxy, and then let the supernovae evolve, put them in randomly, spatially, and see how long it takes. We have detailed thermal and metal evolution that we follow. How long it takes, they set up winds, for example, and some of the metals flow out to leave the galaxy, and some get reincorporated back. So we're trying to really see if the POP3 stars made metals, whether they get transported out to the intergalactic medium, or in which case you can make a case for they're relevant for enriching the IGM, or if within a few million or 10 million years they quickly get reincorporated into a finite metallicity POP2, then that's saying that potentially they may have existed, but they're not cosmologically relevant. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the key issue, because as far as the stellar time scales are concerned, they're very short.
Exactly.
Imagine the first generation of POP3 stars goes off, and then the next generation is already POP2.
Right, exactly.
But so the issue that you're investigating is how long it takes to...
Yeah, exactly. In all the curves I showed you for randomization, I just assumed that POP3 star fruit was proceeding unimpeded, which might not be the case at all. Actually, what we're finding is the number, it's very dependent on the number of supernovae and how concentrated they occur, because a blast of supernovae often is very efficient at removing the metals and keeping the star formation regions metal-free for a chunk of time. By a chunk, I mean more than tens of millions of years. But the if you have relatively low numbers of supernovae per galaxy, so I'm talking now some like 100 maybe, if you just have 100 supernovae in these proto-galaxies, the metals kind of filter out in a chimney, but they fall back very quickly into the proto-galaxy's disk, and they get reincorporated very quickly into the next generation of stars. So it's really dependent on how efficient that first generation of star formation is.
I guess my other question had to do with silicon is often seen in absorption.
Yes.
And as I recall, that is a product of mass.
It is.
So why isn't that better than carbon?
Because it's to see silicon. It's a feature that requires higher column density systems. So the carbon is an element that's relatively easy. It's the easiest element to see down to the lowest column densities. So in the distribution of systems, the lowest column densities are the ones that are seen to represent the true IGM as such. And the silicon, as I recall, you had to go to 10 to the 15 or 10 to the 16 per centimeter squared or higher. So you're still probing some of the transition systems from the sort of Lyman limit systems to the true IGM. So that's why I didn't focus on that here, but you're absolutely right. It is a massive star product, so.
It's not a question for you, but just in my general education in this field. So there could be a lot of remnants of these POP3 stars now. So how many typically?
Well,
and what are they there?
This is an interesting point. I think there's two angles. If you look at it from this, like how many stars you need to exist for reionization metal enrichment to occur, it's just a few percent of the baryons. So a few percent of the baryons, of which perhaps 20 to 30% at most are locked in remnants. So the cosmological density of remnants from what you need for reionization is actually relatively low. But coming at it from another angle, which is there.
So a few percent of baryons would be.
Less than a percent
less
of baryon. Yeah.
Of would be in remnants. POP3s.
Yes, you don't. Certainly, from the data, you don't need more than 1% because you only need a few percent to do the work that we see. But coming at it from another angle, say you had a top-heavy IMF. Which was very, say, efficient at forming stars in a top-heavy IMF. And some fraction of those stars actually completely blow up and return all of themselves to the intergalactic or their post-galaxies. But some large fraction of them just directly collapse into a remnant. And I think there's some papers on the remnants of those stars, so they would be black holes of mass greater than 100 solar masses, up to 1,000 or thousands. And depending again on these unknowns, how many of these were formed, there's some papers on trying to constrain them from X-ray emission in either within galaxies or in between galaxies, these wandering black holes papers. So there's some, but I don't know, I think the third angle though is the fact that microlensing experiments did detect events in our halo, which are dark objects. They're not luminous baryons. No one knows what they are. And the question is...
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah.
So these could be the machos, or is there enough of them?
Well...
What?
The masses are low. Mm-hmm.
Machos are less than one solar mass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if they were stellar remnants, they would... They're really a large component of the dark matter of the universe. And, well, you don't need these stars to make them. I think these stars do not leave a cosmologically...
But still, you say that we mm-hmm. do mm-hmm. need them. We do know they exist, so some mm-hmm. remnants must be left.
There must be
a few remnants of these things around.
There must be, yeah.
Either as black holes or as what?
As neutron stars, yeah, depending on the mass range. And we focused on the present day, this guy IMF between 1 and 100. Like I said, some people have postulated these top-heavy IMFs, so they would leave black holes of hundreds of solar masses. And again, how cosmologically relevant they are, it depends on how efficient the top-heavy IMF is at high redshift. But yeah, I think the machos, there's some, I don't know, I last remember something like 14 or 16 events, and I think the idea... There's not enough events. There's still a big controversy over whether they're in our galaxy or not, these lensing events.
We had a talk last week about how they've seen one uh-huh. towards M, something, towards the Virgo cluster.
Oh, using pixel lensing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess is that Ted Baltz? Or, yeah, I guess he's around, so... I meant to talk to him about that, but yeah, so the machos is unresolved, but I think one thing that people found when studying is that to create those remnants, you produce so many metals, it's really, really hard to hide those metals.
So you don't see these things as candidates for that?
No. In the sense that we don't need that many of these things to exist, and you need, I don't know, about 50 times more of these objects to create the machos, and then you really have to be careful or very clever about hiding the metals, because you produce so many metals to produce so much dark matter and remnants. Thank you.